we'll start, and people can drift in as they will. I'm Bill Strelo, and it's August 26, 1986, and our forum tonight is entitled Ageism, the Graying of America. And to kick it off, we have Howard and Betty Olson, who are on our teaching staff this week. And I must admit, as I look at least my mustache, I'm falling into that graying prospect. And also, I have a 84-year-old father, a stroke victim who insists, as a widower, insists on living independently, and I've learned a lot from him and how possible that is. So, Howard, Betty?
We'll begin by introducing ourselves, and I can see why I was chosen to lead this discussion on the graying of America, but I don't know why Betty's here. I'd like to say that my background is from St. Paul, Minnesota, and there I work in a care center, a nursing home that's owned by 25 Lutheran congregations. And we have about 450 people that live there. 250 of them are residents of a care center, and the others are members of independent living apartment. And this work has enabled me to become quite acquainted with the aging process and the care that the churches, in this case, are giving to them. And I'll let Betty introduce herself.
I'm Betty Olson, over 60, I'm 5. Get some nice reads coming my way. I'm an artist, an exhibiting artist, and teach. And I've been teaching at Augsburg College this summer. But I'm teaching or giving lectures in a program of Augsburg College called College of the Third Age. And it comes from a French idea of they have retired professors. To keep them useful by teaching to retired people. I'm in kind of a confusing situation because I was never totally hired and I've never been retired, so but they said that's all right. But I do mostly lectures. My field is art, so I do lectures on art and some mini art classes. And so I'm through this alternate education. This is another opportunity, and colleges are seeing, are recognizing the numbers in the older bracket that they need to reach out to as their numbers of the younger lessen and to use their colleges in new ways.
A number of you have been in the meetings we've had this week on aging, and I know some of this may be repetitious to you, but on the other hand, I look forward to you contributing to the discussion. I'd like to give a little background and the ground rules, so to speak, for what a forum is. A forum is not a lecture series, it's a cross discussion among people and dialogue between you, and I am here mainly as a facilitator. And to, by way of introduction this evening, I'm going to play about a 1 minute tape here that was prepared for another aging group.
Almost anything. Ride a bike, enter school, smoke, drink, find a job, leave home. It means we've been around long enough to deserve the credentials of age. Age. You can't see it or touch it or hold it in your hand. You know you're older than you used to be, but not as old as you'll get. You know what the calendar says. Age and old are simple words with complicated meanings. Some people say 65 is old, while others call it middle-aged, and still others call it young. Which is it to you? Could its meaning ever change? How about labels like pensioner, senior citizen, retired people, young old, seniors, oldsters, old folks, golden agers, grays, and super 60s? Where do these labels come from? Who decides to use them? And who decides what they mean? People don't all grow old the same way. How can we find the truth among all the false claims about aging? The popular notion of life stages reinforces the stereotypes of age. Most of of us learn to make our behavior fit what's called normal for a particular stage of life. If we don't, we're called eccentric. Because we believe it's expected, some of us think and act old the way an actor plays a role. We all define who we are, partly by the roles we choose to play. As we participate in life with other people, these fellow actors also try to cast us into roles. As child, student, parent, employee, friend, boss, lover, teacher. Remember how it felt when grown-ups shook their heads and said, "You were only a child." How it felt when adolescents started calling you ma'am or sir. Finally, there comes a time when we notice other adults treating us as if we're old. We find ourselves faced with a new role to play. Can we choose whether to play it or not? Together, we can define life changes any way we wish. We talk ourselves into beliefs and behavior, and we can talk ourselves out of them. Stereotypes start with language, and so language needs attention first. Remarks such as, "Act your age, dirty old man," even compliments like, "You're acting so grown up," are actually put-downs that say...
That's a little bit of background of what we want to talk about this evening. I want to read just a couple of paragraphs here to set the stage again, then we'll begin some dialogue. Like many other organizations, the church has been caught off guard by rapid increases in the number of older people. Since 1900, the number of Americans over age 65 has risen steadily from 3 million to 27 million. This age group has grown from 4% to more than 11% of the population. In the last decade, while total population grew by 9%, the number over 65 increased by 23%. Census projections indicate that older people will grow in numbers faster than the total population until well into the next century. By the year 2000, those over 65 will make up more than 1/8 of the U.S. population. World population began to age rapidly too. Between 1975 and 2025, the number of those aged 60 and over will increase from 343 million to 1.1 billion. The most rapid increases are expected in the less industrialized nations. Increases on the order of sixfold will be common. These changes will have serious impact on third world partner churches and on the hunger, refugee, relief, and assistance programs of U.S. churches. Older adults are a significant and growing part of the church. One out of every six is over 65. More than 50% of our church members are over 50 years old. These older adults have interests, concerns, and needs that differ somewhat from other age groups. The last couple of days, we led off with a few statistics, and Nat had some, and I'll just tell you a few others so you know the realm of what we're talking about. The older population statistics and the acceleration of the number of older people is just skyrocketing in America. And it'll be a major situation to deal with in just a few years. This is called the real scoop on aging. 210 Americans reach the age 100 each week. I heard a speaker recently said there are 20,000 Americans today that are over 100 years old. In a very few short years, that will be 2 million. 56,000 people past 65 get married every year. 10,000 get divorced. I don't know what that means. One out of six elders has children age 65 or over. The world's 60-plus population was 376 million in 1980. In 40 years, it'll top 1 billion. At the turn of the century, the average male spent 3% of his lifetime in retirement. In this decade, he is spending 20% of his lifetime in retirement. Almost two-thirds of all Americans retire before the age of 65. Over half of the oldest old, 85, report no physical disability whatsoever. And as I told a group yesterday, we have to, in our own thinking, categorize what we call old. We can't think of the whole gamut of everybody over 65. Where I work, we call people old when they're 75 and over. And over 85, we call the old. And the over 85 group is the one that is accelerating faster than any others. And you have to realize that the old are the ones that suddenly become the frail elderly who require a great deal of care. And we could talk about any of this facets of this we want this evening. It's such a widespread field that we've tried to narrow it down to make our discussions a little more meaningful to us. And I can just briefly review some of the things that came to mind or came up in our sessions yesterday and today. Many people were interested in finance, of all the ramifications of how this is all going to be paid for. Others brought up the questions of how do we put meaning into our life as we're older. And then the intergenerational relationship was a subject for discussion. Yesterday we talked about some other things, about what is the age? Is it chronological? Is it physiological? Or is it a state of mind? A lot of it has to do with attitude and the old saying, we're as old as we think we are, as we mentioned here. So I'd like to just ask you to start off. Does anybody have any particular questions they want to ask me or any of us or talk back and forth about?
Yeah, as I said in the opening, my father's 84, the widower now for 14 years, two or three strokes. And he refuses to go into a home where he has to be regimented. And my problem is believing him. So maybe this is my problem that I'm talking about. But how equipped are we to deal with, as a society and as a church, to deal with the independently minded person who, by hook or by crook, is going to take care of him or herself?
What does he tell you when he leaves his house? He wants to go out feet first?
Yeah, that's right. He wants to go out feet first. He's cost too much to get sick, and he can't afford to die. So. Lately now, he's talking about the meaning of his life. There's little or no meaning in it, other than what he makes for him. And, you know, why self-pity? You know, he hates, this is a quote, I hate people who pity themselves, who feel sorry for themselves. And yet he's coming around now to recognizing that's exactly what he's doing for the first time in his life. He's feeling sorry for himself. And that's a whole new agenda for the two of us and now Karen to talk about. And I just wonder if anybody has a similar situation.
My mother's in her 80s. She's able to take care of herself. And when we talked to her, when she was out visiting us recently, she stayed a week and she was ready to go home, you know. And she went back with my sister in Denver. She stayed there a few days. They wanted to take her home on the weekend. It would be handier for them. They lived some 200 miles away. But in the middle of the week, she was ready to go home, so they ended up taking her home. So there's a real strong feeling there of the need to be in your own home, your own surroundings, where you're comfortable. You've been there for 50 years or whatever. That's where you want to be.
Mm-hmm. And she gets enough people supporting her and taking care of her, looking after her.
Oh, yes.
Even though she's in a different city from where you live.
Oh, yes.
She live in a large city or a small town?
Small town.
Okay.
And she has a lot of friends there.
Yes.
Yeah. What's keeping him from being independent? What cannot he do by himself?
Well, actually, very little. I mean, he's not confined to a wheelchair, but he can't really walk on his own anymore. So he finally convince the doctor to write a prescription for a wheelchair and work that through Medicare. He can't really bathe himself because he's afraid to get in the bathtub. And he didn't want anybody to come in and clean his house. And so some acquaintances persuaded him that he needed to do that. So what he's learning is more and more to rely on other people, and that's really new for him. I would surmise that it's new for other people like him. To cry for help. And I as a pastor can deal with that with parishioners, but with, and it's my own father, and it's hard to separate your emotions. Cry for help. And he just resists being socially engineered. Why don't you go into a home? He says, because I don't want to eat at a certain time. I can't have my beer. And I think there are other people like him.
In our home, they have a Miller Time group of men, and they do have a beer in the afternoon. We're really modern, yeah. It's kind of an interesting sidelight. Many years ago, my mother was on the board of this home, and she finally got a friend of hers in, Anna Danielson, and Anna started to teach everybody in the place how to play poker, and that was really verboten. And now, 20 years later, they've got all kinds of recreation going on, and everybody's playing any kind of cards they want to think of. So it's kind of an enlightenment, I guess, that we're living in.
You're asking, don't the women have, can they have a beer too? You said the men got together.
That's right.
Well, regard your father, there is care for people who want to stay in their home, so is there? And there's more and more of that. Just things like wearing beepers and honing into a central call so that more people who even have risks can stay in their homes that are being set up in cities. What are some of the other programs? Medical people come in, nursing.
Oh, sure, home health care. There are many, many programs.
One of the biggest mistakes people make, I think, in trying to take care of older people is moving them away from their friends, from their church, taking them to live with them, or putting them in a home somewhere away from where they have been living.
Mm-hmm.
And it disrupts their whole life. They don't adjust as easily. They don't make friends as easily. It's hard for them to get to their church many times. And that's a nucleus of many of their lives.
Any change with old people is traumatic. We have people that live at our place when they just want to change a room. The social workers work with them for several weeks in advance to prepare them, to psych them up for this change when it finally comes. And even then, there's a little trauma with it.
Well, I think going back to our community that we were discussing earlier this evening, if we were indeed in community in our churches, we would be helping each other at all levels of life. And I think it's one reason that we should work for community in our church instead of taking them away from their churches, as she was just saying, and needing to change to something new at that time of life. Another thing I believe that would do if we were in community, I've always felt, since I worked with an official for the aging program in New York State, that a wonderful thing for the older people would be to spend time in prayer, as our monastic people do, because they have all this free time. And that is not something you can start when you're an old person. You must start it now, not now, but way back when you're very young. But this is one thing that if we were in community, we would be tuned into that sort of thing, and we would look forward to having all that free time, which now we have nothing to fill those hours. And one of the big complaints with my mother, who is 92, is that she never goes any place, and indeed she does. She goes lots of places, as much as our family can take her to things. She goes probably more than she did 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Is that right? She goes more now than she did 10 years ago?
Well, I mean, because she insists on going when the car goes.
Pardon?
She probably doesn't remember that she goes.
She also doesn't enjoy just sitting around knitting or playing the piano like she did at one time. She likes to get in the car and go.
Sure.
Does your father make his own meals then, or do you have to bring him in? Or do you have
to? He lives in San Francisco. We live in Chicago.
Okay, then you're not bringing him.
You're not bringing
him
a meal.
You said he wants to be independent, be a home. He's living at home.
No, he gets out to a senior center every day.
Oh.
And, you know, he finagles the system to suit his needs and has a meal there and brings home a doggy bag. And on the weekends, he has fruit that he's, you know, has in the freezer that he cooks, or at least attempts to cook.
He feels he'd be too regimented, but a lot of people who don't have enough activities are living alone in a home and are not seeing people or maybe can't get out. I'm always amazed how much goes on. People that go into senior apartments, go into communities, or go into care center, the amount of activities they're offered them are amazing. Howie's mother, my mother-in-law, how old was she then that we came to visit one day and she kept talking about being in Wisconsin. We live in Twin Cities. And we said, well, she can't remember anything. She's referring back, and we found out they'd loaded them in a bus and taken them down over to St. Croix, and she had been there. And they're taking them to baseball games and over to the state fair, you know, and places we would never have taken her at age 90. She died 94, I think. But I just couldn't believe. But she's trying to tell us where she's been. We couldn't believe her. That a lot of people look on this as regimentation or something they wouldn't enjoy. And there are many activities, and there's a group life there and a community that many of them do not find. And maybe if we had community in our church, you'd find it. Or a sense of living together, it could be satisfying.
I think all of us have stories of people we know that have really led some very active lives at 85 and up to 90 and over 90. And it's really kind of heartwarming and encouraging to see some of these people that their mentality is good and they're still able to get around and do many, many things. At our place, we have one Pastor Vognes who is 97, and if I have a quiet day and want to make it interesting, I go up to someone and say, what did you do when you were working? He started telling me he was born in Norway, and in Norway, when you were in high school, you prepared for the mission field. And he did this when he was 16, 17, 18. He got ready to go, and they turned him down. He didn't pass the exam. And he said, I was going home on the train, and the Lord spoke to me right then. He said, go to America. And he went to America, and he went to Wisconsin, where his brother was a contractor. He thought, if I want to go to the mission field, I've got to learn how to be a builder and a contractor. And he worked with his brother for 3 years, saved his money, went to seminary, graduated, spent 40 years in Madagascar. And now he's back in our place. While he was in Madagascar, he met a medical nurse from Norway. They were married and had 7 children. And, you know, the fantastic stories you hear. And the guy now, I think he's 96 right now. Still going well, and his mentality is great. So there are some really heartwarming stories about how people age and really are productive in those years.
We had a man in our church that was 92 and he got a garden. He walked 2 miles to work and he mowed a lawn twice when he was 92 years old. And, and we had to ask him to slow down and go slowly, like you talked about social workers. Each week he'd work a day less, and it took about 4 or 5 minutes to get him down to one day a week.
Uh-huh.
It was really, really hard on the church, for his life, the community, the community.
Yeah, that's great. Yes?
There's one question I have. This home where you are, you have like apartments?
Yes, independent living, they call it.
All right, I want to ask a question. What is the cost per person?
This is independent and it's subsidized housing. And depending on their income and their assets, they pay anywhere from $50 a month to $500 for a one-bedroom apartment. But they're required to buy 20 meals a month, which are served at noontime. And that meal really gives them a lot of nutrition and also sociability. But that apartment has a manager that has many events going on. Valentine's Day is a big day, and Recently they had the senior prom, even though they're all women, they're dancing with each other. every week there's a lot of activity.
I think this is very interesting. You might be interested in this. In Milwaukee, I have a sister
yes.
who just went into this apartment complex. Now, it was built by the Wisconsin Synod Lutherans.
Okay.
But they would take no government subsidy. And I don't know how they can run it as reasonably as they do. My sister had to put in $20,000 in order to get in.
Mm-hmm.
But when she dies or leaves there, she will get three quarters of it back. She only pays $325 a month. And out of that, she gets her main meal a day.
Okay.
And I think this is really reasonable. And it is a beautiful complex. I just can't fathom it. Now, she only has an efficiency apartment, which is plenty.
That's
all she needs. But the facilities there, and they have so many activities, you know,
mm-hmm.
and buses that take them to all the concerts in town, and she gets in on everything. I just can't believe it.
Yeah.
But when I hear of the fantastic cost of the other things, but the only thing is now when she becomes so ill that she cannot take care of herself, she will not be able to stay there. But yet, this is a place where people can go who no longer can keep up a house or keep their yard work and things like this, which is really kind of an intermediate type of thing. And I'm wondering if this wouldn't be a marvelous thing for our churches to get into and do more of.
I think there are many churches that want to, and they just can't seem to get all their act together and be able to put it all together. They need help, in other words. And when they need help, they look to the government before they look to the church. And in that case, I'm sure it's subsidized by the Wisconsin Senate.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
The $20,000, is that, that's allowed? I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah, that's what we call an entry fee. We're going to build another apartment house where I am, and we want to build it with independent money away from HUD. When you're under HUD, which is Housing and Urban Development, there are many, many restrictions on you.
That's why they didn't want any government in it.
That's a good reason, too. I can just tell you a little experience I had. I've been there 2 years. I was a businessman prior to going there, so this is a career change for me. And we had a waiting list for that apartment where there's 100 units. We had about 400 people on the waiting list. And we have about 7 or 8 replacements a year, so you can see that that's a long, many-year waiting list. Then in the middle of last year, HUD changed the requirements for what the assets could be and what the income could be on anyone that was eligible to be in there, and about half the people were no longer eligible. So rather than to write them a letter and say, we're taking you off the list, we wrote them a letter and said, why don't you come and talk to us? We'd like to go over this with you. And we're near the Luther Northwestern Seminary, and many of those people are seminary professors or retired from the seminary, retired pastors, pastors' widows, many things like that. And we sit down and talk to them, and we found out that many of them have assets, maybe around $100,000. They still may have their home or $150,000, and they'd be very interested in this new building we're going to build. But in interviewing those 200 people, I really learned a great deal about older people, because they're all in their 70s, up to 80, some over 80. And they tell you things like, you know, we're tired of falling down the basement stairs. We got to get into an apartment on one floor, and things like this that make you realize that there's a very great need. They also would like to get in apartments that are near care centers. And even though we have a 3-year waiting list to get into our care center, the people that live in this apartment have the priority on admittance, which is a very big thing.
I think one of the saddest things about a nursing home is the fact that all the people there are the same age. And so it's a different situation from anything that they've been used to before. And at Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, he has caused to be built homes around the university, and people retire and to the university, and they become volunteers at the university. And we visited with one fellow there who was, oh, he was so excited about his job, which was showing people around the campus. And he said they retired to Tulsa from California so that they could be
there, and I think that they enjoy being near people that they see moving around actively. I think they enjoy being near the university activities,
sure,
and seeing young people, and so I think if we could somehow or another arrange so that there is a cross section of pages, and I don't know how you do that, but that's one of the traumatic things, I think,
mm-hmm,
for them, is to move away from the people and all of a sudden find themselves with all people their own age. And how many people have you heard in a nursing home say, oh, I just hate being here with all these old people?
Sure. Because people think of themselves as being younger, you know. Has anyone else had any experience with what I call a retirement community like that? Of course, you folks are living in Arkansas. Is that a completely integrated community like this, or is it mainly... It's...
Well, I would imagine it's about 75% retirees. It's huge. I mean, it covers 17,000 acres, and there's about 3,800 residents in there. So it's like
city.
Beautiful shopping area and so forth. And I think the fantastic thing about it, well, I must say that we're kind of implants there because we're in the south. Most of the people are in the north. It's kind of a joke, I guess, because I'll tell you a few stories about that. I'm fighting Civil War. the fellowship, and as you say, the community is fantastic. I think the easiest way I can put it, coming from the big city and moving down there, it was so fascinating. It was just like turning history back 50 years. And what can you go in a bank and put a check and ask for no identification or anything? And trust me, man.
Mm-hmm.
I picked up just to give a little story. We usually bring pecans up to Wisconsin when we visit our children. And we didn't want to come in to take. Pepper, or whatever you call him, he had a little stand out on the highway, and we spotted that he had him in a, 50-pound sacks, you know, and I said, well, if I take 50 pounds, would you give me a pretty good price? Well, he did. He gave me a good price, and I said, the only thing is, I don't have that much money with me. Will you put a sack away for me? Now, he didn't know me from Adam. He says, take it with you. He says, and the next time you see me, why you can pay me. That's just fabulous, I think, when you run into a situation like that. So all the people there, experiencing this, I think it had a big effect on them. And I don't think you'd find anybody that's dissatisfied. A few of them have left, but very, very few. But this is an interim period, you know, between retirement until such time that you can't take care of yourself.
Do you have any idea what the average age would be of the people living there?
I wouldn't know, but I would imagine it's of the retirees, it's fairly high.
It's in the
70s.
Yeah.
70,
75. It was a thrill when I first got there. Square dancing is a big thing. I filled a complete auditorium with square dancers. You look at these people and you wonder how they can move, you know. And I asked one of the elderly ladies, and I said, how can you do this? Oh, she says, we do this about four times a week, and then we go to see the chiropractor, and he fixes us up.
It's supposed to be the best exercise you can get, square dancing and dancing for everybody. You had a good point when you were telling me the other day, though. You said economically you could not live on what you're living down there in Milwaukee. So your move was even an economic move.
Very, very true, because we have a number of millionaires in there. It's a small number. We don't know who they are. To this day, don't know who they are. But you see all the different stations in life, the medium, and then the ones that have to watch their pennies and so forth.
We have no pension to live on, as other people do, because of the work that people are doing. So we live strictly on Social Security.
Sure.
Plus our savings. You never live on Social Security.
No, plus our little interest. Yeah. But there is no way we could live in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
No, the living is very, very economical where we are. Now, of course, that's a
now,
if
we've been afraid and said there's no way we can make this move and so forth, but you simply have to, you know, be brave, and, but we looked into it all.
Well, we checked it.
You made a good remark earlier to me, though, that your faith in God and the Lord seem to be looking on you with good grace, that things have worked well for you.
That's so true.
If you just live your life like that, which is what I have, and I've always felt like as though He has just guided us. And Adrian never would ever take any of these freebies. It's the first one we ever took. And I never thought I'd leave Wisconsin, not really. But when I saw this area, it looked just like Wisconsin. With all the lakes.
Not really.
The temperature was a little
Do they have the Amish in the covered in the buggy?
They have a few.
Well, are they in the buggy?
Well, I don't think they...
Not the buggy.
There are just a few that do some farming, and we don't see too much of them.
Being from Minnesota, I thought most people were trying to get out of Wisconsin.
Only if you want to be on the same
side. It had to be someplace where I could go swimming.
Oh,
and when I saw seven lakes and all these swimming pools, I think that was for me.
Now, what happens to people in that community as they get older? Say they get to be 90 years old, and maybe, like his father, maybe they need to go to a care center. Is there a...
Well, you know, truthfully, just let me preface that a little bit.
Yes.
I think we're all going to get older. Let's face it, and our bodies are going to give out. We have to. But I think if you live happily, like I think most of these people do, I think a lot of their... Of course, now we have strokes, we have cancer and so forth, and of course we have quite a hospice group there that's marvelous, I think. And a few of them will go into a home where they will have care. And many of them, their children, after a mate dies, the children want them to come back and live with them. And I would say 90% refuse to stay there because all their friends are there. And when sickness comes in like this, for example, we had a friend that had Guillain-Barré's disease. I think you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
And that's slow deterioration, and in the end, it required 24-hour care. Now, no one can do that by themselves. In this particular instance, we all chipped in, and we take one night, and another person would take another night, and so on. Like I say, it was this fellowship, which you don't find in the big city.
Sounds like you touched on community there. Yes.
It sounded like when she was describing what the Oral Roberts thing, he was, his institution is addressing the major problem that your dad was having, and that's going from a caregiver to a care receiver, struggling with that change in role. My sister's mother-in-law was very much struggling with that and infirmities, and it became a real challenge to try and figure out what helped her work through what she had to offer still to the quality of her life. And finally, it was that she knew the most of them, more than anybody, about the whole family history. So her assignment became then to create an entire history book of their clan, their whole family. And she did it with cassette tapes and picture books and all the reams and boxes and, you know, of pictures that most people accumulate through the decades and never really writing back the numbers and the dates of who and what and when and what. That became a real mission that took several years and left a wonderful heritage that would have been lost. And that was tied up so many loose ends for her. It was a wonderful thing for her to focus on, trying to figure out what she could still contribute. And it was a wonderful challenge and a wonderful thing for her.
That's really interesting. How old is she?
She died when she was, in fact, she died within 3 months after she finished the project.
Mm-hmm. She in her 90s or?
No, she was in her late 80s.
Okay.
Something I hear more and more from my father and from particularly one of our parishioners at church in Chicago, who was Joe Sittler, some of you may have heard of him, theologian, is that the church is just very ineffective in talking about aging. There's no theology of it. Just never really pay any attention to it. And I remember Joe and Dad in his own way saying that all these things that the church creates, like care centers and taking people to the ball games, it just is to keep them to thinking of, from thinking about dying. You know, and yet Joe says, even though I can't see anything anymore, I still see the handwriting on the wall. And the church just does not help me with that. So I have people say to me, Pastor, will you promise me that you'll tell my family to pull the plug? And I just would like, perhaps in the last few minutes, to hear to think, has anybody thought of that for him or herself who's getting elderly? Or has that been told to you by your family? Pull the plug. And where does the church help with this?
That's a situation that will be coming up for my father at some point in the future. He's facing dialysis beginning within the next few months. And, you know, you can jockey the numbers around a lot of different ways, and there are a lot of variables, but I expect it within certainly the next 20 years, or probably the next 10 years, we'll have to make some kind of decision about whether Dad will be on dialysis or not. It's that kind of decision you're on. I think you continue to live. If you require that quality of life, then you have the choice not to go to dialysis one day and just sort of let things build in your body and kill you. I just hate it that kind of decision is going to have to be made someday. But Dad, I don't know how his mind is going to go. He may not be clear enough to really make a decision like that. My thought is, once he's firmly on dialysis and a little less afraid of his death, and has had some support from social workers and so on at the hospital that will be helping him deal with this whole thing, that it would be very useful to spend some amount of time just processing that issue with him. So it's not something that is decided yet, but I can sure see it coming.
Do you think his faith will help him greatly and yours help you?
I know mine will help me. I suspect his will help him.
Okay.
He's a very quiet man, and I just sort of assume that since he goes to church on a Sunday all the time and seems to act as though he has faith, that he in fact has that.
Sure.
But it may be a very scary thing for him to face and make decisions about. Most of those people, isn't it kind of a team? You get a group of the minister, the family, the medical person you're going to deal with, so that you all know you're going to be in on this decision, and you get in on it before it happens, so that it doesn't come up in the emergency at the end. And get it prepared, and then it's a group decision. We did talk about living will today in the group, and we got into some things there where legislators are reluctant to pass these laws to make this have teeth in it. It wasn't the one nurse that said there's such pressure on the medical profession and nurses to keep people alive. So will your choices be honored? Not on dialysis, you have a choice, but on some other things. This did come up, and it was really, church needs to get in on this and have it discussed and have their opinions come in. The right to life and the various groups are putting a lot of pressure on that life is sacred, it's got to go on forever and ever. What was the comment this morning? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, if your statistics are correct on the increasing number of people who are older, those decisions are going to have to be talked about more and more in the privacy of individual families and families that share with one another and communities. And I'm just not so sure the church is equipped to do that. We promote life. Our theology promotes life and resurrection, which is it should. But inevitably, people see the handwriting on the wall, and yet so many people, including the church, are off taking people to baseball games, postponing any conversation about that because, and I'm obviously painting broad brushstrokes here, they're afraid of their own death. They're afraid of their own demise. People talk about all of a sudden they begin to notice their body. My father's and other people have lived in his mind so long, you know, mind power, willpower, but all of a sudden now he has to listen to his body and he has no experience with that. And the church has no experience with body either. And so I think it's an enormous concern that we need to work on. And Joe Sittler, who's 83 now, is devoting the rest of his life to this.
He's been writing quite a bit about that.
Yeah, most recently, yeah. Because nothing has been written on it by the church.
Okay. You say the church, do we start with the seminary? Are the ministers prepared to handle this? Can they be the counselors? Where are the programs?
I share your concern. I work for a similar corporation as you do, only about three times larger. Care for 850 people in independent living apartments. Independent living facilities, apartment buildings, and nursing homes, and I'm administrator of the skilled nursing home. And I deal with these issues every day. I sit on a biomedical ethics committee for the corporation, and there isn't a lot of theology on the dying process and how to avoid it or how to accept it or how to confront it. It's an area that clearly needs a lot of work because the issue is, as you say, the statistics are just ballooning. You know, the numbers of people, if 30% of the people age 85 and older who require nursing homes, that number stays the same in the year 2000, there will be 5 million people in that age group in the year, in this year there are 2.1 million. So it's going to more than double. If 30% of that population currently in nursing homes in the year 2000 need to be in nursing homes. It's going to be a real crunch in where do the beds come from in nursing homes. So what's being done about that? Well, people coming into nursing homes are coming in much sicker. They are coming into nursing homes to live well. They're coming in and staying shorter times and dying sooner. So the issues become 10 times more frequent. You know, when do you let death occur and how do you do that? My perception is that 90% of the people who need to address those issues in the nursing home have already addressed them themselves. But the difficulty comes when the family and the church and the community haven't addressed them at all because they've been so busy going on about the business. Mm-hmm. And now they want to interfere because they want to avoid death. Mm-hmm. And so you get a call from somebody across the country, maybe a distant cousin, that even after talking the issues through with all the close family, it's the peripheral family oftentimes, but not always, who want to come in and make an attempt. Or they fly in and they say, no, you got to do everything, 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 and then they leave, not to be seen for another 6 months or the funeral. And that's where the problem always comes. It's the people who want to be supportive but don't know how to address the issues.
Right. We talked about that this morning for a little while, and that was the same conclusion everybody had, that the family is the intervening one against the wishes of the person.
That's not an easy question.
There's a new book written, they were quoting me today, that whose life is it anyway? And the person wanted to die and they wouldn't let him die. Such.
It impacts, I think, the economic crisis that brings to hand too, because when we're spending 65% of the Medicare budget annually in the last year of life, the outcome's still the same. What are we spending all that money for?
And that, of course, prompts my mind to think of Governor Lamb of Colorado by saying that we should let's let the people die and spend the money on the living. I don't know. He may have been ruthless in that statement. He tried to backpedal it, but he at least speaks to that issue. But again, what would the church's theologians, or what would be the people's in the pews, which probably where the greatest truth is, to be to this? Would one want the plug pulled on them?
Becca? Don't you think a lot of it has to do with the kind of communication that has gone on in the family before? Mm-hmm. If there's been good communication before, there'll be good communication at the time of dying and death. If there have been taboos in certain areas that you don't talk about before, they're not going to be able to do it at that point either. And so in a way, it's a situation that congregations need to address, the whole thing of communication and openness. And I know the first parish my husband served, a young man was dying of leukemia, and he was married and had a small child. No one in that family was ready to talk about it because no one had really been communicating about much of anything. And it was tragic because everyone knew what was happening, but no one could speak the words.
Let me clarify a little bit. That may or may not be the result of what communication was like to begin with in the family. Part of my training at the university, the School of Social Work, is so interesting things about how people react around death. And silence among people is the first and strongest defense, because of course nobody's ready to face death until you go through the process. Dying people often say, I had to take care of the people around me instead of them taking care of me. There can be interventions made, and there can be, and they can be made by family members who happen to be a little wiser, maybe a little more objective, a little braver. Or you can have people come to you from the outside, like social workers or doctors or nurses, or some kind of person who comes in and shakes things up and starts talk flowing. That's just part of the dynamic of death.
But there's also the thing about how you predict when it's going to happen. So how ready do you get? Because the minute you're ready, it doesn't happen. You have to wait, and then you aren't ready. And then you hurry up and get ready again, and it doesn't happen. So it happens when you're least ready. And that happens more and more frequently in society now, where death can be prevented so easily.
Do you have chaplains at your place taking care of this? I often wonder in a for-profit home where they don't have any chaplains present, must be a different scene.
I think there are some for-profit homes where they do have chaplains who provide services.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a difference there than having one on your staff.
Well, we'd like to summarize a little bit. Does anyone have any particular comments they'd like to make at this time in regard to, you had your hand up?
Well, I was just going to say that in our congregation, we did get into this a couple of years ago by deciding first to talk about funerals and practices in our Sunday morning, a special time. And then it evolved into issues like death and dying. And the thing that sticks out in my mind is that there was an elderly woman in our congregation whose husband had just been through kind of a lengthy illness in a nursing home. I've never heard her talk in church ever. She always comes to the service where there's not that discussion period following it. But she came and talked about how she felt about that and how she felt about her own death and what her wishes would be. And it was, well, you know, to all of us there, it was very moving, and I'm sure made us a lot more aware of ourselves and started thinking about it and our parents and so forth. That certainly is, I think older people differ in whether they like to be with other older people and whether they like to be with different generations. But certainly we have a lot to lose if all the older people move off into whatever, because we lose what we can, all those things we can learn from them.
I'd like to finish on a kind of a positive note here tonight and read just a few lines here from this chapter in this book on affirmative aging, saying the challenge to ministry, opportunities for older persons. But it makes a statement that it is hoped that in the decade of the 80s, the church's concept of ministry of the whole person and all the people of God will do the following things. Recognize that most elderly as well as the young are potential channels of God's grace. Realize that spiritual gifts and the fruit of the Spirit are given by the Holy Spirit to old people too, for their fulfillment and for their use in ministry. It'll be supportive of old people's yearnings to relate to and to contribute, and to be aware that a person can be born anew at any age. And I think on that note, I'll conclude the meeting. Thank you all very much for being with us.
Sleep well.